I want you to imagine with me for just a moment that due to political conflict and unrest and ultimately being conquest and so forth by the country of Russia, that we have been taken over by the country of Russia, and that we are being resettled, that we are being taken from our homelands, and we are now being forced to live in Russia. And they want us to be like the Russians. We would be in a culture that we don't know. We don't speak the language. At least I don't know of anybody in here that speaks Russian. But we don't know the language. We don't know the politics. We don't know the food. The food's different. Basically, we don't know how to fit in. We are in a culture that we are not familiar with or comfortable with. We're in a land that is not our homeland, in a country that is not our country. Now, I know that might be a stretch to imagine, but of course that happened in ancient times all the time. And I guess that it could still happen again, even to the mighty nation of the United States of America. We don't know what the future holds. But one of two things would likely happen. On one hand, we as Americans, we might be assimilated into the culture. In fact, many Americans over time would eventually be assimilated into the culture there in Russia. They would dress like the Russians. We would talk like the Russians. We would learn the language. We would eat the food that they have over there and learn the dishes that they eat and eat like they do. We might even intermarry with and beget children that would have heritage of both and eventually just become like the rest of the Russians. Or we might all form an enclave. We might have these little pockets of American colonies, or not colonies, but communities, rather. These enclaves surrounded by everybody else there in Russia, all the foreigners are foreign to us. And we would all be together and be isolated as much as possible because we want to retain our American ways. And we don't want to be a part of this culture, and we want to speak English. And we would be with people that we are familiar with and in a culture we are familiar with. And so we isolate ourselves in much the same way that you have Chinatown in New York and in California and other places like that in the United States. And we would just wait it out, hoping that one day we get to go home and be back in our homeland. Well, spiritually speaking, the New Testament uses this type of language to talk about how we as Christians are not physically removed. We're not being forcibly removed from our homeland and transferred somewhere else, but we have decided to be part of citizens of a different country, of a different land. When we become Christians, we have a new family, we have a new culture, we have a new homeland. And though we still live here in this community, we are living as exiles here on this earth. Birmingham may be our home. The Birmingham metropolitan area may be where we grow up and where we live and where we die, but we are citizens of another country. The question is, how should we live as exiles here in this place? While we're here, how do we live and how do we behave as exiles? Do we, as in the illustration before, do we become assimilated into the culture around us? Oh, we may claim that this is not our home, we're just passing through. But do we become assimilated into the culture to where we start to talk like everybody else around us? We start to look like everybody else around us. We start to behave like everybody else around us. And soon it becomes apparent that we are just like everybody else and there really is no difference. Or we could huddle up together and not want anything to do with the world, not want anything to do with anybody else from the world. We only want to be around only our Christian friends and family. And so we don't touch anything else. We don't involve ourselves with anything else. We build hedges around ourselves and isolate ourselves and protect ourselves from the world. I would suggest there's a third option, And it's actually the biblical model for how we are to live as exiles. And that is that God does not call us to either assimilate into the culture, and He does not call us to be isolated from the world. Those are the two extremes. But rather, God calls us to be faithful in our conduct. God calls us to be faithful to our calling. God calls us to be faithful to who we are as we live and work amongst the world. As we are exiles here and still we are involved with the world, we are to be faithful to Him and faithful to our calling. In Daniel chapter 1, please turn there for just a moment, please. We'll get to our text, our main text of 1 Peter in just a moment. But in Daniel 1, there's an example of this with those who were in reality exiles from their country. Of course, Daniel and his three friends had been part of the Jewish nation that was conquered by Babylonia, the Babylonian Empire, and King Nebuchadnezzar. And they were taken over to Babylon. And it says in verse 3, the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. Their purpose here was to take these people and assimilate them to make them Babylonians. He even gave them names that were Babylonian names. Look at verse 6. We have Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah. Daniel, we know. Those other three names are not as familiar to us, but we know them more by their Babylonian name. Verse 7, Daniel was given the name Belteshazzar, but to Hananiah it was Shadrach. Mishael was Meshach, and Azariah's name was changed to Abednego. So they were given Babylonian names. They were given Babylonian jobs. They were given Babylonian food. They were taught the language and the culture. They wanted them to be assimilated into that culture. But what we see in Daniel chapter 1 is that Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah were not going to forget who they were. They were going to be faithful to their calling. Even though they were living as exiles, they remembered that they were part of God's family, part of God's nation. They were Jews, and they were going to be faithful to Him even while they were in exile in Babylon. And so, verse 8, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. There were certain dietary restrictions that he was not going to give up just because he was living in a different culture. He was going to remember who he was. And he and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they all decided, we are not going to disobey God in this matter. And they were faithful to Him. Later on in the book of Daniel, most of you know the story about the statue that Nebuchadnezzar built and that everybody was to bow down and worship this statue, and they refused. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, we remember who we are, and we are not going to bow down to this statue. Oh, we may live here, and we may work here, and we may interact with the people here, but we're exiles, and we're going to remember who we are. Daniel, later on, had a choice to make. The decree went out. Nobody prays to Yahweh or any other god or any other person. Nobody prays except to the king. And as soon as Daniel heard that decree, he went home, opened up his windows, and prayed to Yahweh in the sight of all, just as he had always done. He remembered who he was, and he was not going to be unfaithful to God and to his calling as a servant of God. Peter uses exile language in his first epistle. He calls upon the idea of being foreigners, of being pilgrims, sojourners, exiles. And he does so, he uses that language to make a spiritual point. It may very well be, by the way, that the people he is writing to have actually been displaced, that they were Jewish Christians that were displaced and forced out of the city of Rome into other parts of the Roman Empire. And so there's that material or that physical component to his language. But certainly he is making a spiritual point that we as Christians, no matter where we live and whether we have been forcibly removed from our own home country or not, we are exiles on this earth. We are sojourners. We are pilgrims. And we are living in a different country than the one that we belong to. We're going to look at four principles in this series. We're going to have a four-part series on living as exiles that comes from 1 Peter 2, verses 9 through 12. And the first principle that I want to cover with you today is that we need to remember, we must remember who we are. And this is true whether we're in our car or on the highway, in the grocery store, whether we're at work, whether we're at home with our family, whether we're in school, whether we're watching the football game, whether we're playing with our friends, we must be faithful to who we are. We must be faithful to who we belong to, regardless of the circumstances we find ourselves in. Well, who are we? If we are to remember who we are, just who are we? Take a look at our text in 1 Peter chapter 2, because he tells us exactly who we are as Christians. 1 Peter 2, verse 9 and following. He says, "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lust which war against the soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation." Here in these verses, Peter tells us exactly who we are. We are to remember these things about us. Number one, we are a chosen generation, the New King James Version says. Other translations, other versions use the word race, a chosen race. The Greek word there is genos, from which we get our word generation or genealogy or even gene. It means offspring or kindred, family, many individuals of a similar kind or nature. And as I said, it's also translated as race. Well, what is our race? What is our generation? I mean, it's not in the sense, of course, of, well, this one generation, like we talk about today, we have the, you know, we got the me generation, we got the X generation, we got all these names of generations, these people that are growing up together. No, we're talking about a race of people or a kind of people, a group of people here. What is our race? When you have to fill out some paperwork and ask you what your race is, are you Caucasian, Native American? Are you African American or Asian? What is your race? And you add a little checkbox there. I'm a Christian. That's my race. That's my generation. That's my family. I'm part of Jesus' family. That's who I belong to. And that affects how we act in this world. If we recognize that that we are part of this chosen generation, that we are part of Jesus' family, God's family, part of Peter's family, part of Daniel's family, part of Mishael and Hananiah and all their family, we understand that we are part of those people, then it will affect the way we live, the way we work, the way we interact with other people. Those people remembered who they were. And if we're part of that same family, if we're part of that same generation, then we remember who we are. And we have family standards. You know, each family has different standards for what they will do, what they won't do, and what they're involved in, and so forth. We have family standards in the Reed household. For instance, when it comes about to the subject of what we're going to watch for entertainment and what we're not going to watch, there are some very important standards that we have. Two of the most important is, number one, we don't watch the Star Wars prequels in our household. We only watch the good Star Wars movies. We don't watch those horrible prequels. I mean, that's an important standard that we must have in our household. And then second to that is that we don't watch Christmas movies before Thanksgiving. I mean, that's just a standard that we have in our household. Now, obviously, we have some disagreeing standards over here. Y'all watch Christmas movies before Thanksgiving. Seriously, though, when it comes to our entertainment choices, we have standards about what we are going to watch, what we're not going to watch. And there are certain shows that are not appropriate, that we do not believe that we should be watching, or certain movies or music that we're going to listen to. We have those family standards. But brethren, our standards, while they may vary from person to person a little bit, they need to be based upon Jesus' family and upon Jesus' standards. They're based upon the standards of what he says, the fact that it's part of a Christian family. And so, therefore, the decisions we make, for instance, in regards to our entertainment choices, is based upon the fact that we're part of this chosen generation. People ask who we belong to, what family you're a part of Jesus' family. And so, therefore, there are certain standards that come along with that. And that's the way we need to approach this idea of living as exiles. We're part of Jesus' family, so we don't watch these things. We don't talk this way. We don't talk like these other people over here. We don't use those kind of words. We don't talk about those types of subjects in vulgar ways. We don't dress in certain ways. We don't wear these types of clothes. We don't go to these type places because we're part of Jesus' family. We're part of that chosen generation. But being part of the chosen generation, the chosen race, the family of Jesus, isn't just about the things that we don't do. I think that that's a mistake that we have made way too often, is Christianity being part of the family of Jesus is a list of don'ts, a list of thou shalt nots. It's also about the things that we do. And the people of Jesus are kind. The people of Jesus are generous. The people of Jesus are liberal when it comes to giving. The people of Jesus are loving. We are supportive. And we love even our enemies. Romans chapter 12 and verse 20. Do you remember what Paul said? He said, if your enemy is hungry, what do? Pass him by? Laugh at him? If your enemy is hungry, what do? Feed him. If your enemy is thirsty, what do? You give him drink. Jesus in Matthew 5 said that you love your enemies. You've heard it said that you love your friends and your family, and you be good to those who are good to you, but your enemies? No. See, part of Jesus' family is being a completely different type of person than everybody else and living in a way that's different from everybody else. And so we go into the world and we bless and we help and we serve in order to give glory to God. We are representing Jesus. And so we need to recognize and understand who we are and how that affects the way we live. I'll give you an illustration. As many of you know, I work part-time with Shipt Grocery Delivery. And I go to Publix and I shop for groceries for people and deliver it to their homes so that they can just sit at home and prop their feet up while I go shop for them. Now, many of them are working. Many of them are dealing with small kids, and so it is a convenience for them. And so I go to the grocery store, and many people have road rage. Many people have issues when it comes to people on the road and getting in their way and pulling out in front of them. Well, I have grocery buggy rage when it comes to shopping in Publix. You have these people that are taking up the entire aisle and completely oblivious to everybody else and blocking me and not getting out of my way. And I'm on a time limit. I'm on a deadline here. Come on, people, let's move it. That's what's going on in my mind. But I'm wearing my ship shirt. I got to be careful. Because what I say, what I do, how I interact is going to reflect upon Shipt. And so I bite my tongue, and I smile, and I ask them if I could help them, and I just patiently wait and go around because I'm representing Shipt. Brethren, we need to consider that we are wearing our Jesus shirt all the time. And that we have a shirt on that says, I am part of Jesus' family. I am a Christian. And if we were to physically wear that every single day, you think that might curb some of our tendencies when it comes to how we interact with people? Because then they turn around and they see that shirt and say, so that's how a Christian acts. That's how part of Jesus' family acts. Brethren, we need to remember who we are. And that in every situation we find ourselves in, we understand that we are part of that chosen generation, that family of God, that family of Jesus. But he says you're not only a chosen generation, he says that you are a royal priesthood. When we were baptized, for those of us who have become Christians, when we were baptized, we became part of that new family, that family of God. We were adopted into this family of God. But we were also cleansed. We were made holy. Acts 22, verse 16, Ananias tells Saul, "Arise, why are you waiting? Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins," calling on the name of the Lord. There is that defilement that sin brings to our souls that needs to be cleansed. And when we are cleansed, when we are purified, we are sanctified. Sanctified is part of the process, or is the same thing as becoming holy. We weren't forgiven our sins, brethren, just so that we could sit around isolated, hiding from the world and waiting until the day we die so we can go to heaven. No, we were made to be saints. We were made to be priests. We were made to be holy so that as priests we can serve God while we're here. I think about the process that the priest had to go through in order to be cleansed, to be clean, and to be able to enter into service. And you can read about that in Exodus and Leviticus. And there's a very detailed ritual that they would have to go through to become consecrated. And brethren, in a spiritual sense, we have been consecrated. We have been cleansed. We have been made priests in order to serve the King. We are royal priests. Look back in our text, 1 Peter, but go up a few verses. Verse 4. 1 Peter 2, beginning of verse 4, he uses some of this priestly language here as well. He says, "Coming to him as to a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious." That's speaking of Jesus, of course. He says in verse 5, "You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." In this interesting metaphor here, we are not only the stones of the temple, that we as Christians make up the temple of God, but we are also the priest serving in that temple. Every one of us are priests. Every one of us are stones in this spiritual house, in this temple. And we are serving and offering spiritual sacrifices. We don't offer physical sacrifices, and I'm very grateful for that. I'm glad that we don't have to slaughter cows and sheep and bulls and goats and so forth. I'm glad we don't have to do that. I don't know how. I mean, I guess if I had grown up in that culture, I would have just dealt with it and I would have been okay with it. But I'm glad we don't have to do that. Our sacrifices are spiritual sacrifices. Romans 12, verse 1, Paul says, "I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies as a living sacrifice." That we give up of ourselves to serve Him. Who are we? We are a royal priesthood. We are serving our God. And how does this look in our daily lives? Moms, listen to us. Moms of little children. How does it look in your life as a priest? Did you know that changing dirty diapers is priest work? Oh, it's very much priest work. All you do for those children, in providing for them and caring for them and in raising them, that's royal priesthood work. When you go and you sell your product for your company and you represent your company, you're doing priesthood work. Really? How is that priesthood work? Because you approach it with a completely different attitude, with a completely different understanding of what your work is about and who it is you're representing. You're representing your God. You're representing your King. And so the way you deal with the customer, the way you deal with your company, the ethics behind all of that is priest work. Those of you who are in school and you're doing your homework, you're doing your schoolwork, and you're in class and you're taking a test, you're doing priestly work. Because Just the way you approach that and what you do and what you don't do, even in your schoolwork, is affected by who you serve. You serve the King. Whatever it is, all we do, all day long, we do it as an offering to God. We are presenting our bodies as a living sacrifice. And so we are His priests. But He also says in our text in 1 Peter chapter 2, and verse 9 and 10, that we are a holy nation. Oh, salvation is certainly individual, and we have our work to do on an individual basis. But brethren, we are a part of something much bigger than ourselves. We are a part of a nation of God's people. You are not alone. Oh, it may feel like you're alone at times. It may feel like you're the only one, except for when you come in here on Sundays and Wednesdays, but you're not alone. When I was going to Huffman High School growing up, I think there was somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,500 to 1,600 students at the time, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. And if I am correct in my understanding, and from what I knew, there were four of us. During my 4 years, there were four of us there at that school that were Christians. All four of us were from the same church, the 77th Street Church at the time. Four. It may be that in your high school, you were the only one, or that you are the only one, or you're one of the, again, a very small handful of people. At work, you may be the only Christian there. You are in the minority. You are in exile. These are not your people. But, brethren, you're part of a bigger thing. You're part of a holy nation. And we're doing this work together. And tomorrow morning when you get up and you go to school or you go to work, even though you may be going alone, understand that you're also going in with locked arms with everyone here. And that we're in this together. And that you're locking arms with every Christian and facing the world together. And brethren, we need to rely on that blessing of being a part of God's nation of people. So that even when we're not physically together, that we are mentally and spiritually, and that we're praying for one another, and that we're communicating with one another. And it's not limited to Sundays and Wednesdays, brethren. If the only time you see and interact with your fellow Christians is Sundays and Wednesdays, you're doing it wrong. We are part of a family, a part of this holy nation that needs to work together. The church plays a special place for those of us that live in exiles, that live in exile, and we're out there doing what we're supposed to be doing. You're doing what you're supposed to be doing. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, being faithful to our calling, but we're not alone. We need to remember who we are. We are part of a bigger nation of people. And he says also that we are God's own possession. The New King James says it a little bit differently. He says in verse 9 that his own special people. Other translations say God's own possession. I want you to consider with me just a moment what God did, what Jesus did, how much God has given and given and given, and how much he sacrificed. And you consider Jesus leaving the glories of heaven and all the comforts of heaven and everything that goes along with that glory. And he came to earth in the most humble way possible, lived in the most humble way possible, didn't have really much of a home, went from place to place, relied upon other people. And he tells at one point that he has nowhere to lay his head. Foxes have holes and birds have nests. Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And then he leaves the world in the worst possible way when it comes to the worldly view. He was crucified as a criminal. That's the worst punishment anybody could have received in the Roman Empire in the first century. He was crucified as a criminal. He gave up so much so that you and I could gain so much. He gave, but he also received. What did he get in return? what was his return on his investment? It was us. He gained you and me. That's what he wanted. He wanted you. We are his possession. We are his people. He chose Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. He chose him and said, I'm going to start with you and I'm going to make a nation of my people with you. And the Gentiles may have thought, well, that's not fair. But because of Jesus now, we all can be part of God's family. And it was, of course, through the family of Abraham that all the nations of earth are blessed. And we are the family of Abraham now. We are his possession. We are his people. We don't get to pick our physical fathers, you know. Some of you have great fathers. Some of you probably don't even know your father. Some of you wish that your father was not your father. That better not be any of these three right here. But we don't get to choose our physical fathers. We can choose our spiritual father. He chose us. He wanted us. And he wants you to be his child. He is the best father there is, and being part of his family is the best thing imaginable. There is nothing like it. We are his possession. Just think about that. The God of the universe, the creator of the universe, the one that spoke everything into existence, says, I want you to be part of my family. And I will bless you. I will give you everything you need physically, spiritually. We are his own possession. That's who we are. And we need to remember that. We're not just anybody. We are somebody special to God. Turn with me to Jeremiah 29, please. Jeremiah chapter 29. We sing that song, This World Is Not My Home, I'm Just Passing Through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. And obviously there's truth in those statements. But in a very real sense, this world is our home. And we're not just passing through. We're here for the duration. Unless, you know, Jesus comes back first, we're going to live here and die here. Birmingham, it's my home. This is my community. In Jeremiah 29, God, through the prophet Jeremiah, speaks to those who are in exile in Babylon. And they had been told by false prophets, oh, we're not going to be here for very long. It's only going to be a couple years. We'll be going right back home. Don't worry, everything's going to be fine. And Jeremiah says, no, that's not the case. You're going to be here for a while. Look at verse 5. This is what God says to the exiles, those who were carried away captive from Jerusalem. Verse 5, build houses, dwell in them. Plant gardens, eat their fruit. Take wives and have children. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters to husbands so that they may bear sons and daughters, that you may be increased there and not diminished. And, notice verse 7, seek the peace of the city where I have caused you to be carried away captive, and pray to the Lord for it. For in its peace, you will have peace. How are we to live as exiles? Oh, God's not saying become assimilated into the culture there in Babylonia. Don't become Babylonian. Don't be just like the Babylonians. That's not what he's saying. But he's saying you're going to be there for a while. Live there. Do the things you got to do, but remember who you are. I'm the one that has sent you there for one. But even while you're there, pray for the peace of the city. You want good things to happen to the city. Brethren, if God was talking to us today, he would say, build houses, plant gardens, have children, let your children get married and have children, and pray for the community you're in, and bless the community, and be a light to the community. Remember who you are. Be faithful to who you are. Be faithful to your calling. Don't become just like them, but don't be isolated from them either. You have to interact with them. And the only way you can make the world a better place is if you interact with the world. The only way you can influence and be a light, a shining light, and be salt is if you're interacting with the world. But while you're doing that, remember who you are. Be faithful to the calling that God has given you. Who are you? You're a chosen generation. You're a special people to God. You are His priest, serving Him in all the work you do, wherever you find yourself. You are that holy nation. You're not in it by yourself. And you belong to God. God wanted you. And He bought you with the blood of Jesus. There are some of you that are not part of this family yet, though, that you have not taken the offering that Jesus is giving. Just in the days of Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, just in the days of Peter and the people that he was writing to, the same thing is true when it comes to what happens to those people who decide they are going to be part of God's family or not be a part of God's family. Ultimately, there is judgment waiting for those who do not want to be part of God's family. There is destruction. There is a final judgment that is coming. But for those who want to be a part of God's family and decide that they will remember that God is their Father and obey Him and follow Him in their life, there is nothing but blessings waiting. I encourage you this morning to decide or to re-decide to be a part of God's family. Remember who you are and the way you live and what you do. If we can help you be part of that and to realize your full potential and be a part of God's special people, won't you come? Together we stand as we sing.